Cachimbonas, welcome to episode 4 of season 7 of Radio Cachimbona. Radio Cachimbona is an abolitionist podcast that audio archives state repression and fierce migrant resistance in the U.S.-Mexico borderlands and breaks down case law and politics from a leftist perspective. As a daughter of Salvadoran immigrants, Yvette prioritizes uplifting the voices and histories of Central Americans. This was a very special episode where I had Ahilan Arulanantham and Mariah So here to discuss their Mapping Deportations project, which is now live and everyone can go look at. I highly recommend it. The link will be in the show notes. And it's a stunning project that is providing data visualization to show the countries that the U.S. has deported people to across time. And there's many striking findings from their data visualization. And one of the ones that struck with me the most is that the majority of people who have been who the U.S. has deported are actually from Mexico and Central America. And even though, you know, as Latinxes, we might have maybe an intuitive understanding of this fact, but it's, I think, really helpful to have hard data to prove this as well, and also just demonstrate the ways in which the immigration system has always been used as a means of whitening the U.S. settler colonial nation state and policing its racial categories. So there's much that we discussed that I think you all will enjoy. If you enjoy the episode and want to support the podcast, the best way to do so is by becoming a patron. Patreons get access to The Lit Review, which is a book club for Cachimbonas. Myself and other women of color do book club style chats. And I've unlocked a few of them that are on the podcast feed if you want to take a look and see if you're interested. But I greatly appreciate all the Patreons because they're the only reason that I've been able to continue podcasting for this long. There's hidden costs to podcasting, website fees, hosting fees that platforms will charge for hosting the show, the Zoom subscription, just a bunch of stuff. And so this is really a labor of love since the patrons are really the only people that are supporting me financially. I think it's super important in this time of rising authoritarianism to invest in the voices that we trust. So I urge you all to donate if you're in a position to do so. If you want to support the podcast but are not able to do so monetarily, which I totally understand in these difficult financial times, another great way to support the podcast that is 100% free is leaving a rating, a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or whatever platform you're listening on. It helps the podcast find new listeners. It helps it gain visibility. And I just personally love hearing why you all listen and continue to listen. It really fuels me to keep going. So the link to join the Patreon will be in the show notes. Also encourage you all to follow at Radio Cachimbona on Instagram, X, and Facebook. The link to join the Patreon is also always in the link in my bio. Thank you, as always, to Grant Bloom for the intro music and for audio editing, as always. I hope that you all enjoy this episode. Bye, Cachimbonas! Today, I'm so honored to have Ahilan Arulanantham and Mariah So here to talk about their Mapping Deportations project. I'm so honored to have them both. It's going to be a really rich discussion. Wanted to give the listeners a bit of their background so that y'all know where they're coming from. Ahilan is a professor from practice and co-director of the Center for Immigration Law and Policy at the UCLA School of Law. He teaches in the law school and also maintains an active litigation practice. He successfully litigated a number of cases involving immigrants' rights, including Franco Gonzalez versus Holder, the first case to establish a federal right to appointed counsel for any group of immigrants, Jennings versus Rodriguez, which secured the due process rights of immigrants jailed for years while litigating their deportation cases, and most recently, Ramos versus Nielsen, a challenge to the Trump administration's plan to end the TPS program for immigrants who have lived here lawfully for decades. Ahilan has argued three times before the U.S. Supreme Court, most recently in the fall of 2021, on behalf of Americans of the Muslim faith who were targeted by the federal government for surveillance because of their religion in FBI versus Visaga. He has also testified before the U.S. Congress on three occasions and served as a lecturer at the University of Chicago Law School and at the University of Irvine School of Law, where he taught on preventive detention. Ahilan's parents are Sri Lankan Tamil immigrants who left Sri Lanka to escape race discrimination and sporadic violence. Several years later, after they came to this country, the Sri Lankan Civil War began, causing much of his extended family to flee Sri Lanka. Ahilan has remained interested in promoting human rights in Sri Lanka and has also represented several Sri Lankan Tamil refugees during the course of his work with the ACLU. In 2016, Ahilan was named a MacArthur Foundation Fellow. Mariah So is a GIS specialist for the Ralph Bunche Center and the Million Dollar Hoods Project. Mariah received her master's degree in geographic information systems from the University of Redlands and her bachelor's in environment, economics, and politics from Scripps College. Her research interests include critical cartography, indigenous methodologies, and interdisciplinary storytelling. Before we get into it, thanks to you both so much for coming onto the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Likewise, thank you.
To start, I wanted to ask you all, what inspired the Mapping Deportations Project and what did you hope to accomplish with it?
So this started with a hallway conversation that Kelly and I had way back in the spring of 2019, right after I had joined Million Dollar Hoods. And she had this question about a map that she wanted me to make. So at the time, she was giving a series of lectures about the peopling and unpeopling of the United States, and looking specifically at three types of forced migrations that help tell that story. And so one of those is the forced removal of indigenous peoples. And there's an amazing animated map of that from Claudio Fson called Invasion of America. So there's this great animation that's interactive to help tell that story. The second forced migration is the transatlantic slave trade. And so there's also a great animated map that helps tell that story from Slate. I think it's the transatlantic slave trade in 2 minutes. And then the last forced migration is mass deportation. And there wasn't a visualization that went along with that. And we hadn't seen anyone attempt to do it. So that's what she had asked me in that hallway conversation. And I was so not necessarily excited because it's not the most happiest topic to, you know, document. But I know that it's important to investigate and look at those patterns across time. So we've been working on this since way back in at least May, June of 2019. So that's where it initially started. And we had created a beta version of the map and then had started talking to Ahilan and some of the projects that he was working on. And it just kind of blossomed into a bigger project than just this first initial map that we had imagined. So I'll pass it off to Ahilan to talk about how that transition happened.
Yeah, so I came to UCLA in 2021, just a little bit before you, Yvette, I think, and had started to try to do research on the kind of legal origins of a lot of different immigration laws and cases and policies and regulations that date back into periods when it was very, very clear that immigration laws were motivated by race discrimination. Part of that came out of work that others had done, including Kelly, actually, Kelly Lytle Hernandez, mm-hmm. who Mariah was talking about, and also attorneys at the Federal Public Defender's Office in San Diego, tracing the origins of the illegal reentry statute, the criminal illegal reentry statute, which is the most prosecuted federal crime. Mm-hmm. Its origins traced directly back into 1929. A lot of very openly racist eugenic policies that were driving immigration policy at the time. And it occurred to us that there was a lot of immigration law doctrine, statutes and cases, and like I said, regulations and all kinds of things that have similar origin points. So we were looking into that, and we're in the kind of course of researching that when Kelly and Mariah showed us their map, and we realized that actually we were working in parallel on really, really similar kinds of projects. And so that's sort of how we combined forces. And I remember the first time I saw the like very early beta version of a map that Mariah showed that she had done, which is a version of what's now the landing page main map on Mapping Deportation's website. And I was just blown away, you know, even being steeped in this work and having litigated race discrimination claims in immigration context for so long, I still was just blown away by the sheer enormity of the visual representation of deportations and how overwhelmingly they fall upon non-white, non-European countries generally, and Mexico and Central America in particular, and how much of it's recent and all that. So I just thought it was an incredibly powerful way of presenting what we were trying to show through, you know, endless legal writing, you know. And so that's kind of how we combined forces.
And Mariah, since you're the data specialist on the project, how did you compile this data? What data sources did you use for this project? I assume you had to go through a lot of disparate materials to eventually be able to compile this really comprehensive story of where people are deported to.
Yeah, honestly, that's part of, you know, what took so long is compiling the data was no small task. Mm. They're all from, you know, yearbook reports from federal authorities. So right now, that means that it's the yearbook of immigration statistics from the Department of Homeland Security. And then historically, the entity that's creating those reports has changed just how, you know, the immigration has been housed in different departments, you know, whether it's the Immigration and Naturalization Service when it existed, you know, from 1940 to late 1970s, you know, earlier on, it's something about like the Commissioner General on something and the Treasurer of et cetera, et cetera. So it's these yearly reports that are published by whatever department is in charge of tracking immigration. So that's part of the challenge because they only existed in like Excel format from like 1996 onward. So everything from 1995 to 1895 was just PDFs.
Wow.
So myself and some students helped me go through almost all of it's like entered in by hand. You can use, you know, some tools to help scrape it, but you know, some of the years, especially in the 1970s, are like PDFs of a Xerox, like really difficult to read. So yeah, just it really needed that human touch just to ensure the accuracy. So that's something that took a really long time. The other thing that was really difficult was just the terminologies would change.
Mm-hmm. That's what I was thinking.
Yeah. And so, you know, at one point there's like debarred from entry, which is what exclusions are more commonly referred to now. Sometimes deportations are referred to as removals. There's also voluntary departures. And since I was new to like this field, it was really important to then go to Kelly and Ahilan and ask, like, what do these terms refer to? Should I grab this table or not? And then also just recognizing that we started with mapping just deportations or deportation orders, but the structure of the mechanisms of enforcement is so much larger. So that's why we also have all these other visualizations on the website that also have voluntary departures, Title 42 expulsions, exclusions, just because those mechanisms are different. Which ones make up the largest proportion of that enforcement structure through time will shift. So that's also something that's interesting. But yeah, it was quite the challenge and the puzzle, just trying to figure out how everything is categorized and why it was categorized that way. Other thing to just notably mention is from, 1897 to about 1930 something, it's recorded by race or peoples. Mm. And then after that, it's by country of nationality. Every once in a while, country of destination. So those are also some challenges to just when you're trying to summarize data over such a long time period that went into that.
Thank you for that. And I really admire the painstaking hours that you took to create this visualization. And I'm so excited for listeners to go to the website and see the product of all your hard work, because that is no small feat, tracking all the deportations that the U.S. government has engaged in since 1895 is quite a feat. So thank you so much for doing this work.
Thanks for recognizing that.
On the Mapping Deportations website, you all write, Mapping Deportations invites you to see the history of U.S. immigration enforcement, not as a series of disconnected events, but as a pattern. And Ahilan, you started mentioning this a little bit about how there are certain countries that are definitely overrepresented in terms of where people have been deported, but wanted to ask you both, what is the pattern of U.S. immigration enforcement that you found through this mapping project?
No, I think certainly there's many patterns, and there's many visualizations on the website and a lot of different information at different points in time. But for me, what really struck me was that despite the massive changes to the rules of immigration law, they're happening constantly. I mean, you read the newspaper today, every 3 days there's a new change to the immigration laws. There's a real deep pattern where the immigration laws function to engineer the racial composition of the country. And it seems that those patterns persist, maybe not entirely unchanged, but they are remarkably constant over time, going all the way back. And I think you can break it up into kind of two parts. One thing is, a huge function of the immigration law has just been to expel people from Mexico and Central America. Mm-hmm. And Mexico is continuously the number one country receiving deportation orders since 1916. It is the number one country for every year, during that, from then to today. And for huge chunks of those times, also countries, El Salvador, Guatemala, Honduras, make up, 2, 3, and 4 in some order or something like that, are in the top five. The other thing you find is that throughout the entire period, when you compare to admissions, Europe is disproportionately favored. So the total number of deportations to Europe is roughly the same as what it is to the Caribbean, which is a grouping that we have, which is just like, Haiti, Cuba, Dominican, the Caribbean, and also Asia. Even though if you compare the number of admissions from those two regions to the number of admissions from Europe, of course, there's like a massive, massive disparity, right? So why are there as many deportations to Asia as there are to Europe, even though there's been so much less immigration from Asia? In fact, virtually all immigration from Asia was banned actually for something like 60-ish years of this time period. And even after that, it was much, much smaller than you would expect relative to population. And so, this is another example, I think, in which you see this pattern operating over time, even though, like I said, the laws have changed a million times, in that time period. I don't know if Mariah, you have other things you'd say about that.
Yeah, I mean, I think on one hand, there's like patterns within the numbers or the statistical side of things. And, some of those major patterns are that, in 127 years, 96% of all deportation orders that have been issued have been to people from predominantly non-white countries. Mm-hmm. That disparity, if you look at it through time, it's something that increases. So with our website, it's organized into five time periods to help kind of break down, you know, 100 plus years of information to go through. And in our last time period, that's 1991 to now, which we've called Deportation Nation, the disparity is now almost 99% of all deportation orders. So that's just something that's kind of been increasing and ballooning over time. And I think the other kinds of patterns that are helpful to connect from the numerical statistics and percentages are all of the policies and pieces of legislation that help produce, you know, why is it that or who is it that's getting targeted by for deportation or for removal or different types of banishment, like voluntary departures or the Title 42 expulsions. And that this those types of patterns of who's racially targeted is pretty consistent. And it even traces back to our first time period is, you know, the roots of immigration control. And we have a map that animates indigenous land loss alongside the expansion of U.S. territory that's happening from 1790 to 1865. So you see that expansion happen westward at the same time that different states and territories are enacting bans on Black migration. And so in that way, you visually see the relationship between indigenous removal and Black exclusion as being parts of the roots of immigration control before we even have our first data sets on deportation orders that we have in like 1895 forward. So this is all of the structures that help set up the infrastructure to make those enforcement mechanisms possible.
I really appreciate you sharing those historical linkages because I don't think that people always draw those connections.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I feel like if Kelly were here, she would have, you know, she would have said one of the things that drawing that connection that Mariah was talking about does, it shows you how the traditional starting point that people think of for federal immigration law, which is Chinese exclusion in the 1880s, is actually connected to these older projects of racial exclusion, Native American expulsion, removal, and the slave trade itself, and the massive limits on the migration of both free Black people and regulation, obviously, of enslaved Black people's movement. And in our telling, the first federal immigration laws, deportation laws that actually have an effect, that result in deportations, are much, much earlier. It's like 1803 federal law that backs up state laws that ban the migration of free Black people into the United States and prohibit their entry and also authorize their deportation from slave states. This is coming at a time right after the Haitian Revolution, because the Haitian Revolution has just resulted in the liberation of all these Black people in Haiti. And there's a huge amount of fear in the United States that movement will now spread here. And the immigration law is brought into service to prevent the entry of people who might have these liberatory ideas. It's like there's a lot of stuff going on in the website. We at the time periods that Mariah was talking about, a number of detailed individual entries, timeline entries that talk about particular discrete events, like the one that we're just talking about, and others going right up to the present day, that helped to draw those connections.
Mariah, you mentioned that the first year where there was a deportation record was 1895. I just wanted to make sure I heard that correctly and wanted to ask why that year was chosen as the one to start documenting deportations for the Mapping Deportations Project.
Yeah, that's mostly just a reflection of what data sets available. We weren't able to find anything much earlier. Technically, from those annual yearbook or annual reports that I had mentioned, the earliest I think we have is 1892. And the only reason why we didn't incorporate that into the main map is those had included both the debarred from entry and deportation orders together in one number. And since we were focusing just on deportation orders for the map, we just decided to start a couple years later. So that's just a reflection of, as far as we know, That's the earliest recorded data sets that we were able to find. Especially for consistency as well, just coming from annual reports, coming from similar sources, helps just ensure a certain level of consistency as much as possible.
Got it. So when I was looking at the visualization of the map, I was struck by how in the first few years of the 20th century, the countries with the most deportations fluctuate, and it seems to be related to differing constructions of whiteness over time. And then Ahilan, you mentioned that in 1916, that's the year where Mexico starts to predominate as the nationality facing the most deportations, and wanted to ask why it is that that shift occurred.
I think, you know, it reflects the fact that what counts as white is a malleable concept to some degree, reflecting the fact that obviously race is itself a social construct. It's not a, you know, bound in some determinate biological or immutable fact. You have like Black people on one end of the spectrum. They do not, unless they pass, you know, the Black countries, Black majority countries do not, you know, move across the racial line. And you've got sort of white Northern European, you know, countries on the other end of the spectrum. But then, you know, for example, Jewish people, people from Italy and Southern Europe, people from Eastern Europe, even, you know, their statuses are more ambiguous and they can move and shift. So you have a good number of deportations to Southern Europe and deportations of Jewish people, partly, I think, out of disfavor of Southern Europe, also tied to ideological things, like they're perceived as anarchist and communist in different kind of time periods. But then, you know, fast forward to now, and you have remarkably favorable treatment of Ukrainians and Russians, even during the Biden administration, relative to Afghans. You know, you've got these parole programs that result in hundreds of thousands of people from Ukraine able to come into the country. Which, to be clear, I favor, you know,
right.
I think, you know, but if you compare that to the treatment of people from Afghanistan and then later from Haiti, Venezuela, Nicaragua, Cuba, you know, pick your Cameroon, you know, pick your country, is far more restrictive rules applied to those people, because now Ukrainians have sort of become white. Mm-hmm. Whereas I think it's not so clear that they would have, at least all of them would have been treated that way in a different period of time. And so that, I think that that's part of the answer to your question, is that it reflects these shifting notions of race. And of course, there's cases about this. Like there's, you know, Japanese people who argue that they're white and therefore should be allowed to naturalize, and Indians, Punjabis, who argue that as well in the 1920s, for example, the teens in the 20s, for example. I don't know if Mariah has other thoughts on that subject.
I think another thing that's related is just the categories that are used, whether it's like the race or pupils or just the country of nationalities. Those categories are can be a way of erasing different racialized experiences. And particularly for indigenous folks from Mexico and Central America and south of the imposed border. And so one of our visualizations is called Hidden Data. And so that is an attempt to try and estimate out of all of the deportation orders throughout our data set about what percentage of them would be possibly indigenous, based off of a reflection of what the indigenous population is in the home country. Mm-hmm. It's undoubtedly an underestimate, just because over time that population has undoubtedly changed. But it's an attempt to at least push back against that invisibility, because the ways in which that invisibility functions within the data set is also reflective of the kinds of racism that's embedded in indigenous removal that we were talking about in the roots of immigration control. So there's definitely, you know, caveats in the way that the data is interpreted. And so one of the questions that we pose at the end of that visualization is, who else is, you know, invisibilized when we use large national categorizations or regional categorizations, and just ways to kind of poke through at that more to talk about who is it that gets racialized in particular ways and relationships to what kind of spaces.
That's super interesting. I'm sure it was very interesting to see the changing racial categories that the government was using to understand the people it was deporting. Since these are racial constructs, I'm sure they used very interesting categories to try and make sense of the people they were deporting.
Like Hebrew. Like, who knew?
Really?
Yeah, that's in there.
Interesting.
Mariah taught us so much about this. I have to say, I didn't study any of that in immigration law. There's like all these strange categories that are in the early teens, you know, the late 1800s and early teens.
Yeah, there's a distinction between Southern and Northern Italian.
Oh, wow.
So in there, you'll also see like different geopolitical changes, even just with the countries and how they're related.
Mm-hmm.
So that's also an aspect of it.
So another one of the time periods that you all focus on, you mentioned this, that you call it Deportation Nation, and that's 1990 to now. You note that the 1990s saw a huge increase in deportations, 5 times more than in the prior 200 years. So wanted to have you all break down what factors motivated this increase.
So definitely a huge chunk of it is a legal change in 1996, which makes it possible to issue what we think of as deportation orders. They're now removal orders to people who previously would have just sort of been turned around, essentially denied admission, or perhaps been received a voluntary departure. And that means one way of concretely thinking about it is you have a decrease in due process, right? Because now you have a more harsh order being issued against somebody without them going through all the process that would have been previously available. It also is a reflection of just a massive increase in resources going to immigration enforcement in the border region, which begins with the passage of IRA-IRA, you know, in 1996, AEDPA, and then more IRA-IRA in 1996. And then mushrooms even more after the creation of the Department of Homeland Security in 2003. And I think someday when somebody updates this, we'll say and mushroomed again in 2025, you know, with the massive further increase, right? And so you have a huge increase in removal orders being issued as a result of that. I think also this reflects trends in interior immigration enforcement as well.
Mm-hmm.
You could point to a lot of different things. The huge increase in the number of very small, low-level crimes that for which people can be deported. I know, Yvette, you know these rules very well. You know, that come in the 1990s. You have the data sharing systems of secure communities and the rise of what they call 287G agreements, which, you know, incorporate state and local law enforcement into immigration law. This is what allows the Obama administration to deport more people. Trying to, if I can remember this right, something like in 8 years, then we're deported in the first 100 years of American history. I think that's, or the first 100 years of American immigration law. I think that's right. Something in that neighborhood. And
I just
by
got
far,
goosebumps.
Is that right? Yeah. I mean, it's horrific, right? And more than had ever been deported in any prior administration. We may see those numbers reached again in this administration, possibly. I don't know. But you know, these different kinds of legal changes just cause a massive increase in both immigration detention and then also deportation. Those mirror the change in mass incarceration as well. And there's a fantastic visualization that is on the website, one among many that Mariah put together, which shows the pattern of mass incarceration and mass deportation. You can see they just move in lockstep with each other during this time period. So that those are, I think, some of the phenomena that are going on in that time period that help to explain it. I don't know if Mariah has other thoughts on this.
No, I think that was great.
Perfect. So to start wrapping up the conversation, I wanted to ask you all, how can the Mapping Deportations Project inform a more humane immigration policy moving forward? And is there any way to create borders or have a system of immigration enforcement that isn't racist? And if so, what might that look like? And I know this is a very tall order, but you all are so steeped in this, and this is such an amazing tool. So just wanted to get some initial thoughts on what that might look like.
Yeah, I think in terms of how mapping deportations can be a tool is, one, I think the one of the key reframes is, you know, sometimes folks will say, you know, the system is broken, not, you know, functioning like it's supposed to. But when you trace the full history, you realize, no, actually it's functioning exactly as it was designed to. Mm. I think that critical shift helps change what the interventions are. And I think the wonderful aspect of the timeline that goes along with everything is you can then map out what policy interventions are needed in order to make those critical shifts. Because you can also see how, you know, all these policies from way back in the 1920s or even earlier are being enacted today support this deportation machine that we're all in. And so I think as a tool, that's one, you know, really critical piece, because you can actually map out what policies can you intervene on and try to push to change. So that's for the first question. Ahilan, I don't know if you want to go back and forth between the two.
Sure. I mean, I think if you try and think of the website as a tool of imagination, you know, what could the world have looked like? And therefore, what could it look like even now going forward? There are some great visualizations that can help accomplish that. There's the last visualization on the home page, on the landing page at the bottom of it, is a reverse map. It just runs the basic mapping deportations map that's in the landing page, but backwards, imagining what if all these people that have been excluded were to come back. You can think of it in the form of reparations. I don't know if you your listeners would know Tendai Achiume's piece about migration as decolonization. She was a former colleague of ours. I don't know if you all, maybe you guys didn't quite overlap, huh?
No, I was so sad that we didn't. But yes. I'm a big fan.
Yeah, it's a brilliant scholar with a really important piece about thinking about migration as a form of reparation for colonialism. And this map really kind of encapsulates that, not limited to colonization, but more generally all of the racial exclusion that's been the product of deportation law. Another one is there's a blank map, which I mean, actually, maybe Mariah, I should pass it back to you. I have something else I want to say about from a policy standpoint, but why don't I pass it back to you? Actually, maybe you can say something about the blank map.
Yeah, so there's a blank map that in part mirrors, there's two other maps that we have about mapping out the whites-only immigration regime. And so it has a bunch of quotes from different lawmakers from, you know, when that regime was kind of put in place, the immigrant quota system that was also put in place, and kind of contextualizes all of that. And then there's a present day one that does a similar thing, but how the whites-only immigration system has been upheld by the current Trump administrations. And so there's a blank map that is also an accompaniment to it to fill in either the missing parts and connections in the stories, just because there's so much that goes into mapping these histories. But there's also more possibilities that it's not just looking into the past. You can look forward in the future and map, you know, what do those relationships look like that aren't based on, you know, banishment and exclusion and, you know, othering and inclusion based off of where you were born.
That's great. And Ahilan, you had a policy recommendation for making a more humane immigration system?
Yeah. You know, I think, you know, obviously many people have different views about the question of whether you can have a border at all that is consistent with either a non-racist world or a racially just world, or even just a fair world more generally, right? And I think one thing our project shows for me is that at the same time, you can see that the policies of deportation have been so clearly steeped in racism and really have been a project of racial composition, you know, the engineering of the racial composition of the country, right? It also, for me, shows you, like, how different would it be if we had a system that still tried to do the things that we were told, we were taught immigration law was doing, which is like encouraging family unity, for labor productivity and, you know, sort of rational economic growth and, you know, some humanitarian protection systems like asylum and refugee protection and all that, but without it actually being driven by a system of racial engineering. Mm-hmm. You know, without this massive racist ideology and white supremacy driving the policy underneath it. And in that world, we still would have, you know, limits on immigration. We wouldn't have a system where there was, you know, unconstrained admission. You might have a system which had deportation, you know, perhaps for crime, perhaps not, you know, depending on, you know, a number of other things, but it wouldn't be driven by this kind of racism. And how different would that world look? Like, it wouldn't allow for like lots and lots of Europeans to adjust their status and legalize or register through the registry program or have, you know, unlawful presence waivers and all these things while barring all the same things for people who are coming from south of the border. And it wouldn't like make Black migration negative in the 20s when the visa system comes and they just deny visas to people from Black majority countries, like all over the world. And how different things would be in that world. So I think there is actually a way in which, for me, it shows that you can decouple the debate over open borders and immigration restriction as a whole from the debate about whether there should be race discrimination. You know, that's not to say that there is, you know, like I said, it's a complicated question, whether, you know, in general, there's a rationale for borders that isn't tied in these kinds of ideologies. But I think it just shows you could imagine a world that didn't had a lot of similar immigration policy, but without racism, and it would still look really, really, really different than the policies we've had.
Mariah, did you have anything to add?
Yeah, I think in terms of like the question about creation of borders or thinking about that, that's something that, you know, from the get-go, like right after that hallway conversation, I started looking to people who studied critical border cartographies. And something that was really, you know, helpful and has stayed with me ever since is there was this one piece that was talking about how borders are created by how they're enforced. And it's that experience of the border that actually produces the border itself, so the enforcement of it. And then on our webinar launch for this, Hiroshi had made a comment that also really sticks with me that was about how borders conceal and normalize different forms of injustice. And so I think something that's helpful about, you know, this project is unmasking what's concealed and normalized within the enforcement of the border. And that can be either when the statistical points or it can be in the quotes. We have a whole visualization called In Their Own Words that's a quote bank from policymakers and lawmakers all throughout these really long time periods. And they say so much about, you know, what who is considered you know, desired or undesired in that crossing of the border, and who's targeted for the expulsion. So that's one part of it. And then in terms of what does it mean to imagine something different? One thing that I continually think back to, I think especially as a Dene person, is this land has memory of what it was like without colonial borders. And so I've been reading a lot of Leanne Simpson, her book Theory of Water, looking at Nibi, which is, I think, the Anishinaabe word for water as a form of internationalism. Just looking at ways to really challenge the ways that we think about territory and nation building that isn't about enforcement or capital or other things that often go hand in hand and are normalized in it. So that's kind of an opening outward from this project into thinking about something different, but just a reminder that, yeah, there's different stories here that the land remembers.
The last question that I like asking, I've been asking this for a few years just because all the listeners and myself included need something to make them feel hopeful. So wanted to ask you both, what is something that is keeping you hopeful now? And it can be anything, a book, a show, an experience, just anything that rejuvenated you recently.
So I'll be real and say, you know, I've been litigating the TPS cases, and particularly for Venezuelans and Haitians. We just got our second shadow docket stay order from the Supreme Court last Friday. So I'm, you know, there are definitely some things that are not keeping me all that hopeful. But I have to say that I still feel like there's just a huge amount of energy to resist in various quarters. I've seen it in the National TPS Alliance, TPS holder community. Mm-hmm. I've seen it in local patrols of people who are trying to stop ICE raids at the most granular level when the legal system has totally failed, the courts have failed, ICE is breaking the law, the Supreme Court lets them do it. And people come in to say, well, we're going to protect our people because we know it's unjust, even though the law, or I don't know if you say the law, but the court has mm-hmm. allowed it to happen, you know, whether or not the law says it. Those things have given me some amount of hope. This project is really different from a lot of my other day-to-day work, which is just litigation. I feel like this is a process of planting seeds. You know, the government's trying to bury all these ideas, and we're seeding them for ourselves, but also a future generations of people who will understand what's happened with our immigration law and the deportation, the history of deportation in a much clearer and more honest way, because we have told the story. And that gives me hope, you know, the hope that a future generation will see it more clearly than we did.
I love that. Mariah?
I think there's two things. I mean, one is, I think the thing that brings me hope is seeing how folks are coming together from different communities and recognizing that our struggles are interconnected. Whenever there are moments that embody that, I feel an immense amount of hope, because I think it changes the possibilities of movement. And then I'm kind of on a different level, especially because Ahilan used the metaphor of seeds, is quite literally my garden. Mm. Porch garden that I have in the city, and I grow corn from my homeland. And I just got my first one that opened up, and it's this pomegranate color. It's beautiful.
Wow.
And I have these seeds that are beans that I plant with them, and they're from Thaona Odom, so from borderlands.
Yeah.
And
I used to live there for like 6 years.
By the way, we planted those. I don't know what'll happen, but we put those in our little planters box. And when you gave them, you came down and gave them to us at the Mapping Deportations launch.
Yeah, so that's been a practice of mine, is sharing seeds with people, mm-hmm. like whenever I gather. So yeah, I'd given some to Ahilan, I've given some to Kelly. And it's a practice that I started out of grief about 5 years ago after losing my father. And mm-hmm. so it's been this practice of nourishment and relationships. So just giving those seeds to folks, I think, is an embodiment of that. And I like to think of, in my data work, I talk about what kind of knowledge systems do we acknowledge, and what are the ways in which seeds hold memory. Mm. And so handing out these seeds in particular, coming from the so-called borderlands is, in what ways do they remember what it was like before colonial borders were here, and how do they hold those memories, and just kind of what possibility has in that. So that's something that I like to gift folks, and hope that they go and plant them as Ahilan has done and see what grows from them.
Wow, that's so beautiful. I'm so inspired by both of your inspirations. So folks can go to the Mapping Deportations website, and I'll put the link in the show notes. Is there anything else that you want to direct folks to?
No, just thank you, Yvette, for doing this podcast and playing your part to try and make people more knowledgeable about all these issues. Really appreciate your doing it.
Awesome. Thanks to you both.
Likewise, thank you. These kinds of connections and intertwining of stories is so important. So thank you again.
Bye, Kachimbona.